Blog Talk Radio.
Mike Silva here with New York Baseball Talk on FreeTheFan.com Radio. I'm happy to have with me now Matthew McAuliffe. Matt is the author of a book called Bat Boy, Coming of Age with the New York Yankees. It chronicles his experience with the Yankees as a bat boy during the 92 and 93 season. You can get some information about the book at MatthewMcAuliffe.com. Matt, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Let's start with the obvious question. What inspired you to write this book about your experience?
From the time that I was working for the Yankees, people have been very curious about what goes on behind the scenes there and what the ballplayers were like, and didn't know while I was working there that I would write a book, but have been thinking about it on and off and finally put pen to paper.
Now, for the Yankee fans, they might find it interesting that your first game was actually a very historic one. It was the George Brett Pine Tar game in July of 83. Talk a bit about your experience at the ballpark that day, because when reading the book, it seemed like that it really shaped you as a baseball fan.
Yeah, I mean, that really was the first big league baseball game that I ever went to. It was with my dad and little brother, and we were way, way up in the upper deck. And, for people who remember that game, it was confusing in the stadium exactly what was going on, because you knew that Brett had been ejected, but it wasn't really clear why. And all the kind of the myths of baseball and everything that came after that day was so interesting as an 8-year-old fan getting to know baseball and the personalities, and it really kind of hooked me on the Yankees in addition to their rookie first baseman, who was Don Mattingly.
Now, the interesting part is the first time you thought about being a bat boy was a late-season Yankees Red Sox game a few years later that you attended. You go to the game, you sit in the bleachers, and you become inspired. Talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'd seen The Natural, and I knew on some level that there was such a thing as bat boys, but it had never occurred to me that in reality there were, there really were 15, 16-year-old kids who got to sit in the dugout and got to be in the clubhouse and around the players all the time, and went to one of these games late in the 91 season. Like you said, I was, a sophomore in high school, and just noticed this kid who was sitting down the first baseline playing catch with Jesse Barfield, the right fielder back then. And it just occurred to me, why could that kid, why should he be out on the field and not me? And, at that age, didn't know any better than thinking that, I could write Steinbrenner or Stump Merrill or whoever a letter and try and get an interview. And was so naive about it that ended up landing that interview.
Well, one of the funniest stories in the book I found was the process of you getting hired. Not so much that you just wrote a letter to Steinbrenner, but some of the follow-up you had, and then your interview with Nick Priori, the Yankees clubhouse manager. Why don't you give the fans some perspective on that whole process?
Yeah, well, Nick was the clubhouse manager for the Yankees, the equipment manager for, upwards of 30 years. I mean, he kind of bridged Mickey Mantle era all the way through, the Reggie Jackson years, right up through Mattingly and Jeter and all those guys. At the age of 16, this was the first job interview that I'd ever been on. So I put on the one blue blazer that I had as a kid and went ready to go to answer questions about what the type of questions you think as a 15-year-old kid you're gonna be asked on a job interview. So, what's your favorite subject at school? And what kind of a change do you think the Yankees batting order needs next year? And instead, Nick really only had one question to me, which was, are your parents going to mind you taking the train home late at night? Which really is, the most important question, given that I learned very quickly that being a Yankees bat boy is far from a ceremonial position. There's actually a lot of responsibilities and quite long hours, especially for a 16-year-old kid to be taking on.
Now, you're hired for the 1992 season. Obviously, you answered that one question correctly.
Yep.
Which was the season before the Yankees started to become a solid ball club again. Now, talk a little bit about how it was walking into the Yankees clubhouse that first day in April of 1992.
Well, you know, I mean, I think the biggest thing was that, you know, even though I'd been a huge Yankees fan growing up, it had never really occurred to me that these guys who I watched on TV and from a distance, from the upper deck or from the bleachers, were actually real people with real personalities and different personalities and senses of humor and so forth. So, you know, that was the biggest thing, was going from sitting at a distance and kind of looking at these guys as just two-dimensional, you know, like I had a Don Mattingly poster on my wall my whole childhood, and then all of a sudden, one day, I'm sitting on the bench 3 feet away from the guy or having a conversation with him. And so that, you know, really kind of threw me for the biggest loop. And that experience of getting to know them was what made the job so rich over the next 2 years.
Now, you had me going there reading the book. I almost thought there was such a thing as a batch stretcher.
Yeah.
So I don't want to give away too many of the stories because I want people to read the book, but why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, you know, if you can put yourself in my shoes, I walk into the clubhouse and I see all these guys. You know, the big guys on the 92 team were, you know, Jimmy Key was the ace of the pitching staff, and Danny Tartable was a big free agent signing, and then, you know, nobody was bigger than Mattingly, who at that point was already a perennial all-star and multiple MVP winner, and really, you know, my childhood hero and kind of the Derek Jeter figure of the day for any you know, for lots of kids growing up around New York, and was terrified of, you know, even saying hi to Mattingly. And luckily for me, he actually came up and introduced himself to me, and promptly asked me to find him a bat stretcher, which is something that I'd never heard of. But again, if Mattingly asks you to do something, you don't think twice about it. It's my first day on the job, and so I went looking for it, and it's kind of a tried and true, you know, baseball prank. There's a lot of them that go on in the clubhouse, and it was only after I'd been sent into Buck Showalter's office and down to the Red Sox clubhouse and then up the street to Stan Sporting Goods with $20 to go buy one that it finally dawned on me that maybe Mattingly was just kind of messing around with me and, you know, welcoming me into the clubhouse.
Now, fans adored Don Mattingly. He was the greatest player in the 80s on the Yankees, and unfortunately never got to play in a World Series. But being that you're one of the few people that got to know him in some ways as a person, why don't you give us a synopsis of who Mattingly was to give the fans a better idea?
Yeah, I mean, a real clubhouse leader. And, you know, there were two individuals who really stood out from the time that I was working with the Yankees who, you know, who I admired as players beforehand. But then when I really got to know them as people, just can't say enough positive things about them. Mattingly and Jim Abbott was the other one. But, you know, both of those guys, and Mattingly in particular, you know, always ready to kind of lend some insight or ask about, you know, for, again, did Mattingly think of me as a friend of his? Almost certainly not, being a 16-year-old kid. But, you know, it's so meaningful at that age, looking up to somebody so much, for him to take the time to ask what's going on at school, or if, you know, my brother or sister were coming to the game, to take a minute and, you know, say hello to them, or kind of tease me at, you know, in front of them, and so forth. And, you know, generous in every other way. You're making, you know, basically minimum wage and working very long hours and going to school during the day, and he was generous with tips and, you know, even more so with his time.
You also got to meet a young draft pick out of Kalamazoo, Michigan. I think we all know he is today, Derek Jeter, but you met Jeter before he was Derek Jeter. Talk about that young draftee that stepped into the clubhouse that day and what you thought of
him. Yeah, he was definitely already Jeter. I mean, the biggest thing that I remember about that, I mean, he was the Yankees' number one draft pick and very highly touted. And I guess it was soon after he was drafted, he was invited to come to the stadium for batting practice with the big league team. And, you know, was very, you know, like his public persona, I think, is pretty reflective of how he is in the clubhouse, too. And even really at that time, very reserved, very poised, very respectful. And, Nick Priori, the clubhouse manager who I mentioned before, who's, you know, the type of guy who, you know, wears has like a chaw of tobacco and a stogie in his mouth at the same time, like a real old-time baseball guy, who was Nick to everybody from Mattingly to Steinbrenner. I vividly remember Jeter addressing him as Mr. Priori, which we thought was, you know, the funniest thing in the world. But when you hear, you know, Jeter refer to Joe Torre as Mr. Torre, it's I guess it's something about the way he was raised and the way that he carries himself. And even back then, as a 17-year-old, 18-year-old kid, you know, only a year or two older than us, it was you know, you could tell that he was destined for good things.
Now, the interesting part, it seems, that while doing your duties, you actually get to sit on the bench and interact with the players, which, as a fan, I guess, sometimes you forget about that. You even mentioned how one of your colleagues was on the cover of the Daily News a couple of times, you know, congratulating a player after a home run. Did you feel as much a part of the team, more so than you would have as a fan? Sometimes fans put themselves as part of the team, but in reality, you're distanced. I mean, as a bat boy, are you really in that fabric of the team in all essence?
You know, I don't want to overstate it. I mean, it's not like I consider myself playing for the Yankees or anything, but you know, it's you work every single game. You know, 81 home games a year, and you're there 3.5 hours before the game and 3.5 hours after. And as a bonus, we got to travel with the team, so I got to experience being on the Yankees plane and going to Fenway Park and Camden Yards in Toronto a couple of times with the ball club. And so, you know, I do think on some level you're really on the inside. And it's there's a long tradition of teenage kids working in big league clubhouses. So, I do think that for those 2 years, it really did grow to feel like home and like somewhere where you belong.
You know, you mentioned you were on road trips in a few places, and I thought the one that was interesting is when you went to Fenway Park and you're actually out there shagging some fly balls. How was it catching fly balls off the Green Monster?
Take some, you know, as everybody knows, the balls take some strange bounces. There's a lot of dents in that wall, and there's a, you know, that famous scoreboard there has a small little door, and hopefully somewhere in there is, you know, I carved my initials as is the baseball tradition, so hopefully it's still up there on the concrete somewhere.
Now, the other story I found interesting was old-timers day, and I got to tell you, it was really gutsy on your part. You went up to two of the tougher personalities that day to ask for autographs, Joe DiMaggio, and got not one but two signatures out of a surly Mickey Mantle. What overcame you that day with that courage? Because those guys are tough of fans sometimes to go up to.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they both had reputations as guys who were unapproachable. And, you know, part of what I write about in the book is just, you know, it's a very grown-up world. And you know, you kind of necessarily come into it as a naive kid, like wondering, like, you know, God, how would I ever get the guts up to ask somebody like Mickey Mantle for his autograph? And, you know, your first old timers day, you kind of sit there on the sidelines and watch the bat boys who are a year or two older kind of magically come up with these autographs. And then, you know, by and by, you kind of figure out the best way to do it. So I won't spill the beans on the story, but I just was lucky enough to cross paths with those guys and Whitey Ford and Yogi Berra and a lot of those guys. And when they would come back, Old Timers Day, second to opening day, was really, you know, two of the biggest days of the year.
Now, in 1993, it's your second year on the job. You've grown as a person, but the Yankees are growing as a team, and they were in their first true pennant race in a while. Talk about how you changed that year, as well as the team.
Well, you know, by 93, the Yankees actually had some of the pieces in place for their success later in the decade. So guys like O'Neill and Abbott, Wade Boggs, they were with the team by 93, so I got a chance to see them play up close, which was exciting, and, you know, Mattingly towards the end of his career. And then, you know, personally, again, it's a job that traditionally you only have for 2 years, and the first year you're kind of getting to know people and people are getting to know you, but by the end of that second year, you're feeling really like part of the fabric of the clubhouse, and you know different people, you know people in the front office, and you've had a chance to travel with the team and had that, you know, road trip to Boston and all the adventures that that came out of that. So that's really where a lot of the fun and the deeper relationships with guys like Abbott and Mattingly started to kind of come together.
You know, you have a good piece in the book about George Steinbrenner. I know he did a lot of good things, not only for you, for other people, but give us your perspective on George looking back today.
Well, you know, he was, now, 92, the boss wasn't there. He was still, I guess,
suspended.
You know, in his favents and imposed exile. But he came back in 93, and it's true, the man has a temper. I saw it in action. Was never fully on the brunt of it myself, but saw him chew some people out. But personally speaking, you know, the Yankees, and really it was, I think, Steinbrenner who was behind it, ended up paying part of my way through college. After I got into school, it didn't look like I was going to be able to afford it, and my parents to afford it, and somebody suggested that I write Steinbrenner a letter, and never thought that it would come of anything, but the Yankees essentially paid half my college tuition my first year and my second year of school, and you know, almost certainly wouldn't have turned into a writer if I didn't have that the benefit of that education. So for, you know, whatever people say about Steinbrenner, you know, I personally don't have anything bad to say about it.
The other player I think you were around early in his career, and he blossomed into a star, and it was tough for him at the beginning, but give us your perspective on a young Bernie Williams as a player when you were around him in the clubhouse.
Yeah, Bernie, you know, his rookie year was my first year with the Yankees as well, and he was really, I mean, from the start, he really had that kind of gentle aspect of his personality that I think comes out when you see him in interviews, and the fact that he's a pretty accomplished musician. I mean, all those aspects of his personality were already there, but he was, you know, I don't know exactly how old he was, but he was a young kid from Puerto Rico who I don't think had spent very much time in a city the size of New York before. And Mel Hall was the Yankees right fielder at that point, who had something, I think, of a pretty well-deserved reputation for being a bully a little bit in the clubhouse.
And he bullied Bernie, basically, right?
Yeah, he did. And, you know, I don't think that's like secret information. I think that was, you know, something that was reported on even back then. And, you know, I don't know whether somebody in the front office might have intervened, or Showalter, who was manager at that point, may have intervened, but, you know, obviously in that tug of war, you know, Bernie's the one who obviously went on to have a long illustrious career with the Yankees.
Now, you go back 1998 to do some security work. I guess, give me perspective on two things. One, how you came to realize in a way that you had actually outgrown the environment, and two, was the atmosphere different around the team and the stadium from what you left it in 93?
Yeah, well, you know, what you're alluding to is, you know, so I went away to school, and then after school ended up going to law school at Fordham in the city, and when the Yankees made the playoffs that year, got a call from the clubhouse that just because of the intensity of media interest, and, you know, that was obviously the 125-win team that seemed like they were destined to go all the way, that, you know, basically they just wanted somebody who knew the clubhouse, who they could trust, and kind of knew how to be comfortable around the players and so forth to come back. And just because I had never seen the playoffs when I was there, I, you know, kind of left at the opportunity, and it was great. I mean, I got to see World Series baseball from, you know, I didn't dress in a uniform for the games or anything like that, but I was in the clubhouse for those games and got to see all that up close. But I also kind of realized, like I said before, that there's a traditional role in a baseball clubhouse for a 16 or 17 year old kid.
Yeah,
there's a reason they call them bat boys. Mm-hmm. And even though it's, you know, it was one of the best experiences of my life, and you know, certainly the best first job I could, you know, ever have dreamed of, you know, everything must come to an end at some point. So, you know, it was there's not really a role in a clubhouse for a 21-year-old guy, 22-year-old guy who's not really a baseball lifer. And so, you know, had that experience to see everything up close, and it was amazing. And at the same time, kind of realized that it was probably time to hang them up for good and move on.
So now you're in your 30s, a professional, and looking back, how did this experience shape you? Did it have a profound impact on where you are today?
Yeah, it did. I mean, you know, I would say the first lesson was, again, like if I told anyone that I was thinking of writing this letter to the Yankees saying, hey, you know, can you apply to be a bat boy? Or I was thinking of writing George Steinbrenner a letter. I mean, I'm sure that, you know, anybody would have just said that's crazy. I mean, why bother? I mean, those, you know, anyone who's going to get that job is going to be somebody who had a connection to the team. And I was, you know, lucky that I didn't ask anybody. And it didn't occur to me that that was a silly thing to do and a silly thing to kind of be persistent about. And so that, I think, is kind of the first lesson that I've taken away from it, is just to not take yourself out of the game if there's something that you dream about doing. I mean, to kind of go after it. And then, you know, I mean, just, and then second, just generally, it's really an amazing thing to get to know some of these guys as people, and to know that, you know, there are some guys like, you know, I kind of made a decision in writing the book not to wallow in naming names and so forth, but there's, you know, some guys who were more jerks than Mattingly or Abbott types, and it's instructive to know that not all, you know, just because you're a great athlete doesn't mean that you're a great person. But, you know, I think the bigger lessons and the better lessons were from people like Mattingly and Abbott. And really, I mean, I there aren't many people that I've met that are more impressive on every level than a guy like Jim Abbott, who's achieved what he's achieved, you know, despite all the obstacles that he faced, and is one of the most gracious and intelligent people that I've ever met. So, I mean, really, I probably learned as much in 2 years in the Yankee clubhouse, just the education and human nature, as I did in 4 years of college and 3 years of law school.
Well, Matt, I appreciate you coming on the show. Thank you for giving us a copy of the book. We're going to be giving it away in the second hour. And I highly recommend it. It's great reading. It's www.MatthewMcGough, it's MCGOUGH.com. Matt, if you ever need anything from us at Free the Fan Radio at WGBB, please give us a call.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on. I'll be happy to come back anytime.
Thanks. That was Matthew McGough of Bat Boy, coming of age with the New York Yankees.